You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Trita.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Cannot complain. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. You are Trita Parsi, the executive vice president of the Quincy Institute. You've been involved in a very ambitious project called the Better Order Project, which Quincy convened. And we're going to talk about that. It involved policy experts from like dozens of countries and over the period of time and a series, I guess, of conversations, they produced something called the Toward a Better Security Order Report. And there's plenty to talk about. It is, some might say, visionary, definitely ambitious. I would like to start on a personal note that actually connects up to this project with your indulgence. This is, as I said, the Non-Zero Podcast. It's put out by the Non-Zero Foundation, which I founded, which also publishes the Non-Zero Newsletter. All of that is a reference to a book I published called Non-Zero, like exactly a quarter of a century ago. Like it came out in January of 2000. I saw the first finished copies in late December of 1999. The title was a reference to Non-Zero, some games that can have win-win outcome, lose-lose outcome. It's largely a story of human history, about how technological evolution had, you know, carried non-zero-sum dynamics over larger areas and so on, and created richer and richer, more complex non-zero-sum games, and how that accounted for a lot of the kind of evolution of human social structure from hunter-gatherer band to being on the verge of globalization where we are now. And kind of the culmination of the history was an argument that you could expect technology to keep doing this. So relations among nations were going to become more non-zero-sum. And so we were going to need more in the way of cooperation among nations, including institutionalized cooperation, some of which might fall under the heading global governance. Well, wouldn't you know it, the world failed to follow my instructions, Trita. I don't know if that's ever happened to you. Has there ever been a gap between your kind of policy ideal and how humans behave?
Every day, every minute of my life.
Yeah, well, you get used to it. So if anything, I mean, there has been backsliding, I would say, on the kind of international governance front in some ways. But in any event, the point I want to make before we launch into your project and talk about the background is that there may be a tendency among some people to say this is hopelessly idealistic, which is okay. But some of them may mean that in a confused way, I think. In other words, they'll be saying like, oh, this is like ridiculously altruistic. You've got to pursue the national interest. And I want to emphasize, and I'll let you speak for the group and the report and what your aims were. But when I talk about global governance, I am talking about pursuing the national interest.
Exactly.
In a context in which the way you do that, because there is an overlap of interests of multiple nations, is through cooperation. So I consider global governance to be the product of an almost ruthless focus on national self-interest, but a kind of a wise focus. So, sorry, that's my sermon. Again, I don't speak for you.
If I could say just a couple of words on that, because I think it's really very important, because there's going to be that tendency of saying, well, you know, this is idealistic. And, you know, at the end of the day, nations are self-interested, humans are selfish, which I completely agree with. But the idea that selfishness excludes or precludes collaboration is just false on the face of it. I mean, the history of mankind is the opposite. We are the most collaborative species on this planet, perhaps with the exclusion of ants or some insects that live in these type of ways. But bottom line is the key to our evolutionary success has actually been our capacity to collaborate, because it's actually in our interest to do so. So I think it's a rather, almost an infantile objection to think that because of selfish nature of humans, that collaboration or non-zero approaches are essentially unlikely to happen or idealistic or naive mm-hmm. to pursue.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, even if you conclude after hearing this that this stuff is hopelessly idealistic, which I don't think it is in the long run. It's not going to happen tomorrow, but I don't think it is in the long run. I think it's still an interesting exercise to ask, well, what would the world look like if nations rationally pursued their interests, and how far is that from the world we're in? That's just an interesting exercise because it's a long way, I think, from the world we're in.
And if I could say something about the methodology of mm-hmm. what we've done here, which is related to what you just said. We didn't approach this by saying, okay, let's presume that we're rational. We approached it by saying, let's presume it's the year 2040. The world has become undeniably post-unipolar. We're no longer in a unipolar world, whether it's bipolar, multipolar, mm-hmm. we set that aside. And at the same time, we know that certain trends, geopolitical trends, will have continued apace, or we presume that. You know, the climate is still on the verge of collapse. UN Security Council reform has not happened. And as a result, the entire multilateral system is also on the verge of collapse. US and China continue to glide or inch towards a conflict. But we presume that we had stopped right short of an actual collapse. And then we asked ourselves, selfishly, what are countries' interests in this situation? Given mm-hmm. the very deep structural changes of transitioning away from unipolarity, how do countries perceive their interest in that scenario? And given that, does these perceptions, because of these changes, unlock flexibilities that currently do not exist and mm-hmm. allow us for certain reforms and changes to the governing structure precisely because it lies in the interest of countries in that scenario, even though we may not be able to see it today because of all other things happening right now? And from there on, we said, well, if we believe we're going to be in this scenario in 15 years, and if we believe in that scenario, countries will pursue these proposals because it is in their interest to do so, given the circumstances, we can then develop the proposals today and we can already start working towards creating the political space for them already now, given our belief that we will end up in a scenario of this contour in 15 years. So all of that, I would say, is very much based on realistic rather than naive or idealistic mm-hmm. approaches, as well as centering it entirely on the national interests of various states and expecting them to actually act in their national interests.
Okay. So talk a little more about the state of the world right now. You mentioned that we have to prepare for a world that's not unipolar. In fact, we're already in one. But I gather the idea is that in a highly unipolar world, you can imagine a single nation being kind of the guarantor of order in the world, the world's police person. Unless all other nations do a remarkably bad job of becoming more prosperous and adopting new technologies and so on, you're probably not going to have a single world that has that kind of a single nation that has that kind of dominance forever. And I guess your view is that this is just a fundamental and natural trend. Is that the idea? Toward, in other words, it isn't just a contingent fact that we are in a more multipolar world now, but it's just, you know, you just might as well get used to it. And I gather it's your view that the U.S. foreign policy establishment has not entirely recognized this. Is that a fair, or not all of the establishment?
I would go beyond that. I personally do agree that we are now essentially in a post-unipolar world. However, the reason why we focused on 2040 is because we're still in a situation in which it is not just the U.S. foreign policy establishment that has not adjusted to this. This mm-hmm. new reality has not been internalized, I would say, in most capitals. And it's going to still take some time. Whereas they can intellectually recognize that that is where we are right now, it does not mean that policies have been adjusted to that intellectual recognition. Mm-hmm. That's why we gave it another 10, 15 years for that to really start dawning on countries and seeing their behavior change rather than just their intellectual outlook shift. So I do personally believe that we are in that world, but we're not seeing every country adjusting to that. We're seeing some rising middle powers really taking advantage of it, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, etc. But it is still the exception, I would say, rather than the norm at this stage.
Mm-hmm. So maybe it would be interesting to talk about the institution that most comes to people's mind when they think about global governance, which is the United Nations. I mean, some people find it terrifying. Of course, on the far right, the kind of John Birch right, there's long been this idea that, you know, the black helicopter is going to show up any moment, and we will be under, America will be under the thumb of world government, a tyrannical world government. And there are people who still talk that way, including some people in Silicon Valley lately, actually. And it's not crazy to worry about an undue centralization of power. I don't think that's crazy. When you, you know, as governance in some, along some dimensions, moves to the global level, of course you should be concerned about that. But so the United Nations was, of course, formed after World War II. The idea was that it was going to do a better job than the League of Nations had done of discouraging war. And you have some quite ambitious ideas about reforming the institution. Do you want to talk a little about?
Sure. Could I take a step back, though? Because sure. I recognize exactly what you're pointing out, that there are quite a lot of folks, particularly in the United States, particularly on the right, that seems to have a very allergic reaction to anything that has to do with the United Nations or the multilateral system. So let me take a step back, because I think our starting point is to take a look at what the Biden administration really elevated, which was what he called the rules-based international order.
Mm-hmm.
This is a term that actually didn't even start getting into usage until sometimes in the mid-2000s. It is oftentimes spoken about as if it is the same as the post-World War II order. And I think we have to be very clear that it isn't. And even though the Biden administration has presented it as some sort of a status quo instrument, protecting the rules-based order, protecting this order that has existed for such a long time, in reality, I think it's fair to say it's actually an anti-status quo instrument. This is an order, or this is an instrument that the United States, particularly under Biden, has been using to essentially transcend the previous World War II law-centered order towards establishing a rule-centered order. The law-centered order, which is based on the UN and international law, has some significant strengths, which is that, you know, these laws are ultimately, most of them, consensual, meaning that countries sign on to treaties and as a result are beholden to the things that they sign on to. And they're part of the process of developing these laws. Whereas when it comes to who makes the rules, it's completely ambiguous, and reality is it's the United States and a coalition of countries with the expectation that the rest of the world has to follow the rules the U.S. makes, which is precisely why the term rules-based international order is so received with such allergy and contempt, frankly, in particularly mm-hmm. the global South. They see it as an instrument to prolong American primacy and hegemony rather right. than in a governing structure. And to be frank, if you listen to what the Biden administration itself said in the NSS 2022, they do not talk about the rules-based international order as a governing structure. They talk about it, frankly, as a bloc. They say those who subscribe to the rules-based international order will also be receiving military protection from the United States, almost making it sound like a NATO plus type of an arrangement. And this is a significant danger in our view, because what we're risking here is that if the U.S. pushes, which I don't think will happen under Trump, incidentally, but if the U.S. had continued to push for a rules-based order, essentially a club, which then would likely generate a reaction from Russia, China, and others to create their own alternative order, we would not move just towards a multipolar world. We would move towards a multi-order world. And the difference between that and what we had during the Cold War is that, yes, there were two separate orders, but there was also a recognition of a super order above that, which was international law, which was the UN system. It had its flaws. There were massive disagreements, but there were disagreements within the same framework. There were disagreements how to interpret law. In a multi-order world, we will have competing sets of law, systems of law. And that will be much, much more.
Essentially two competing systems.
Well, it depends. It could end up also being three. It all depends on what kind of constellation happens between China, Russia, and key parts of the global south. Mm-hmm. But the issue is that in a multi-order world, it would most likely dramatically fuel great power competition and dramatically increase the likelihood of zero-sum thinking, negative security cooperation, and eliminate whatever little chances we have to have the level of human collaboration that is needed to address shared mm-hmm. threats such as climate, et cetera, et cetera. So I wanted to say this because I think, you know, our conclusion is that with all of the massive flaws of the current system with international law and the UN, I've worked at the UN, I've seen those flaws up front, it is vastly superior to us moving towards a multi-order world in which we have our own sets of laws and China and Russia have their own sets of laws and that we're constantly clashing, or any attempt to reinvent a universal global order from scratch. International law, particularly international humanitarian law, would be so much weaker if we were trying to invent it from scratch today. So yes, we are landing on the side of saying, hey, we actually need to reinvest and reinvigorate and strengthen international law as it is, the UN system, and it needs massive reforms. And that's what a lot of this project is about. But we came to that conclusion because the alternatives, whether it's a multi-order world or starting from scratch, is just so much worse and so much more dangerous, and frankly has very little chance of succeeding.
Yeah. It's funny. I think the advocates of the so-called rules-based order kind of like to blur the distinction between the rules-based order and a law-based order. In other words, they draw on international law when convenient. I mean, this goes way back. Clinton did get Security Council support for the Bosnia intervention, which I supported partly because it had Security Council support. But then when he wanted to intervene in Kosovo, he couldn't get it, so he just did it anyway and said, well, NATO is kind of an international body. It's not the UN, but, you know, so that's kind of okay, right? Similarly, Bush got Security Council authorization to invade Afghanistan, couldn't get it for Iraq, invaded anyway. And so, and I think up to this moment, administrations, well, Trump is in his own category. I mean, as you said, he's not likely to go around advocating the rules-based order. On the other hand, he himself professes to be allergic to global governance. So he has maybe his pros and his cons from my point of view. But certainly Biden, whenever they can claim that something is on the side of international law, they will. And you, I think often when they're not saying that loudly, there's some lawyer somewhere in the bureaucracy who developed a position paper according to which whatever they're doing is consistent with international law. There's a lot of going through the motions of respecting international law. But for example, right now we have troops in Syria. There's no basis for that in international law.
Yeah,
neither for that matter, it hasn't been authorized at the national level. What's that?
Yeah, neither domestic law or international law. We don't have congressional authorization or UN Security Council authorization. Can I say something on that point? Because I think you're absolutely right. You have a situation in which essentially the rules-based international order has evolved into, I'm not necessarily sure that it was incepted as such, but it's evolved into being something that is on top of the international law system. And whatever we can rely on international law, fine. When we cannot, if we don't want to, or whether we are in breach, then we say that it's in accordance to the rules-based international order. And here, mm-hmm. it's interesting. Trump, in some ways, ends that conceit because the Biden administration spoke a lot about that. There's no reference to the rules-based international order in Trump's NSS, for instance. I don't think I've even seen him use that term even once. Mm-hmm. So you're right. He doesn't come at it from this perspective. But it does not mean that the Biden administration or other American presidents did not also hollow out international law or the UN system. The Biden administration in particular did that. Just take a look at how many UN Security Council vetoes they use to protect what Israel is doing in Gaza and in Palestine. Look at how after the one resolution that they didn't veto, immediately they turned around and said, well, this UN Security Council resolution is not binding, infuriating everyone else. But it was in line with a systematic effort to hollow out the UN and international mm-hmm. law. So yes, Trump doesn't care about it at all, completely dismisses it. But let's not fool ourselves. It's not as if other presidents have been aiming at strengthening it or actually have not been hollowing it out. And Biden in particular, I think, is very fascinating. They use the RBIO, the Rules-Based International Order, every 5 minutes after the Russians illegally invaded Ukraine. But we've identified very few instances after October 7th in which the Biden administration has used that term. And the ones they, the instances that they have, it's all been in the context of Ukraine, never in the context of Gaza, which again shows you essentially the deceit that lies behind us and why so many countries, strong allies of the United States who want to be good friends with the U.S., nevertheless, absolutely despise this term because they see it as something that holds them back from being able to get a greater share into the decision-making of this century, given the fact that they're rising powers and given the fact that the old system is based on the realities of 1945, which, of course, have been long superseded by reality.
Yeah, let's talk about those. So the UN was set up with, you know, a Security Council where kind of the real power is, I would say. The General Assembly includes all nations, but they don't. The General Assembly doesn't have the power to authorize a war, which the Security Council does, and to do various other things. And there were five permanent members, and still are, of the Security Council. Not coincidentally, they're the five powers that were on the winning side of World War II. I mean, the winners make the rules. It was Russia and China and France and England and the U.S., all of which still have a veto and are always on the Security Council, whereas the other members rotate, the other 10. Of course, China, has, there's been a transition in the sense that going back to the Nixon era and I guess culminating in the Carter era, I don't know when exactly it happened. I guess the Nixon era, the seat moved from Taiwan to Beijing.
Yeah, 1970 or 71.
Yeah, yeah. I was confused. But so, you know, the structure of the Security Council reflected a fact that I think you ultimately have to kind of accept about the world, which is that powerful players have disproportionate power. That's why they're called powerful. And I think... It would be naive to think that you could distribute power among all of the nations equally and have a very effective, you know, policing mechanism, right? And I would say that the reforms you guys propose continue to respect that principle in a certain way, but acknowledge that there have been changes in the power structure. The U.S. is no longer as dominant, and there are a lot of second-tier nations and so on. So do you want to tell us what kind, broadly you have in mind for
sure.
the Security Council?
Yeah, so let me just also mention broader what the project has done. So essentially, we have developed 20 detailed proposals along seven variables, ranging from Security Council, AI, climate security, economic sanctions, non-proliferation, and some use of force norms around that. And we have, I think, three or so proposals on the Security Council that I think are very, very important. We're going to be presenting these proposals at the next Munich Security Conference, for instance. So you're absolutely right. There's certain realities. Reality is that powerful states are going to have a disproportionate power. But the degree of disproportionate power today is far less than what it was in 1945. Right. The veto strength that was put in place back then can only marginally be changed. Any idea of actually getting rid of it will essentially mean that the United States, China will walk out of the UN as some states did with the League of Nations. So you got to keep those states in. However, that does not mean that some reforms are not possible. So what we have a proposal on the Security Council that does enlarge it. I can talk a little bit about the different countries and systems. But when it comes specifically to the veto, we have a proposal in which, for instance, we do not suggest that the veto alone can go forward in the manner that it has been before. But rather has to be a veto plus one, meaning one state from the permanent members has to veto it, and then another state, whether from the permanent members or another, has to support it. Otherwise, the matter will go to the General Assembly, and the General Assembly will have an opportunity to overturn that veto. I think it's a two-third or three-fourths majority. I think it's a two-third majority to be able to overturn. So this rebalances a little bit the power between the Security Council and the General Assembly. It still obviously leaves the Security Council with the ability to be able to authorize force. The General Assembly does not have that, but the General Assembly has other authorities. I mean, they've been put together missions, mediation missions, and things of that nature. There's plenty of stuff that the General Assembly can do. But we needed something to rebalance exactly the veto issue. The proposals that have been put forward so far, which are good, they go in the right direction, is that whenever a state uses a veto, it has to go to the General Assembly and explain its vote. You know, perhaps it adds a little bit more transparency, but we also heard from diplomats at the UN that it actually doesn't do much. You just have to go through some motions. No. This actually does change that a little bit in that term. But there's another thing that we're also doing that I think is kind of important. So we recognize that it's going to be very difficult to be able to have new permanent members who don't have the veto. There's too much tensions around this point. But we've introduced the idea also that you can actually cast a negative vote without using the veto. So as you know, the ability to abstain was not originally there. That was a reform. The difference between a negative vote and an abstention is this, that we believe that the three additional posts for the Security Council's permanent seats need to be elected by the General Assembly.
And I'm not sure we said that, but you would expand the permanent membership from five to eight, from each of three regions. Is that one country from each of three regions? And those
one
are
from South America, one from Africa, one from Asia. And those, we believe, should be elected by the General Assembly. And we believe a very strong promise by states to say they will not use the veto will be critical for them to be able to get elected. This is something that, for instance, the Brazilians have said that they're willing to defer the right to veto even for 10 years. But if you say that you're not going to use the veto, that will take away your ability to actually cast a negative vote, unless there is an ability to cast a negative vote without using a veto. Otherwise, you just have to abstain all the time, and that's not necessarily what countries want to do. So we're also opening up the possibility for countries to be able to cast a negative vote without using the veto.
Okay. So the U.S. to veto something in this new world, and there are some other structural changes you'd make, but would need to find at least, and if they wanted it to be insulated from any kind of overturning by the General Assembly, as it is now, they would need to find at least one other nation anywhere in the Security Council, which would now be larger in the aggregate, right, that would agree with them. And I mean, you know, it's going to be hard to convince a lot of people to let go of the single nation veto, but it often paralyzes the UN, or has in the past, certainly during the Cold War. And B, you know, if you look at times when the US couldn't find anybody who thought what it wanted to do was a good idea, like invading Iraq, we couldn't find anybody who thought that was a good idea, and it wasn't a good idea. I mean, you know, maybe that's a sign that you should think again. I mean, that's not an example of where that's in some ways not a good example of the actual dynamic you'd go through on the Security Council, but Iraq isn't. But
in fact, the four, or now what is it, five Security Council vetoes that Biden used against Gaza resolutions, not a single other state voted with the United States. A couple of them at various points abstained.
Right.
Not a single one of them voted negative with the United States. So all of those in this scenario would actually risk going to the General Assembly. And given where the General Assembly is, they actually would get overturned.
And, you know, by the way, this just occurred to me. This would in some ways make life easier for a president, because you could say, hey, we voted against, we vetoed it. We did our best, because it's not, I don't think it's like Biden really thought it was critical that we veto all these things. He just thought the domestic politics demanded it, I think. And so, you know, he would have been
He fundamentally misread domestic politics, but I agree with you. He probably thought that, but it also tells you how much
I don't know.
He misread it.
He may understand him better than I do. I don't know. But in any event, it might be a convenient thing in some cases to be able to say, hey, we vetoed it. We did our best. So anyway,
and incidentally, also Russia's vetoes on Ukraine would have been overturned in these scenarios because they did not have a Chinese vote with them or another state. So again, you know, look, I fully understand and respect those who think that the veto ultimately is unfair. I also respect those who recognize that without a veto, you may not have a UN, and as a result, you would end up in an even worse situation. This is unfortunately the entry cost of being able to have something that's designed to make sure that the great powers don't go to war with each other again. We have to keep that in mind. That was the purpose of this when the whole thing started off. But this would go much further than anything else we have seen so far. You know, whether it is the Liechtenstein proposals of you know, explaining the vote, etc. This would definitely take a very substantive way towards rebalancing the power between the Security Council and the General Assembly on this issue.
I'm just, this is a relatively, well, maybe not such a minor issue, but when you say that there would be one from Asia, I assume that India would prevail in that competition. Pakistan wouldn't be wild about that. And you might wind up with a still no Muslim majority country as a permanent member of the Security Council? Or do you imagine the African...
No, there's an informal rule that makes sure. So this brings in another aspect. So we are also proposing something that dramatically changes the Security Council, which is to have a third category. Right now you have permanent and non-permanent members. We're creating a category that is also semi-permanent members who will serve for 4 years, and these will be middle powers. Five of them, which would then expand the council to 23 states, five of them out of a pool of 20 countries. And the reason why this is important is because this would actually, first of all, reduce the competition between middle powers and small powers to get on the council. You have some middle powers that constantly get on the council every couple of years and small powers that don't get on until every 25 or 30 years. This would actually put a situation in which smaller powers are competing with each other, middle powers competing with each other. Also, it helps the situation of Pakistan or the situation of Italy or Japan, who will be very upset because they will likely not get a permanent seat. But the consolation prize is, well, you have a potential of getting a semi-permanent seat. Because you have to make sure that if you want to expand the council and you give this massive prize of a permanent seat to a country like India, for instance, this can create, you know, not only significant resistance is part of the reason why there's been deadlock on this issue. This opens it up for the other, you know, the smaller, you know, the middle powers who may not be able to get the permanent seats and nevertheless get a consolation prize, so that they too also have an opportunity to influence, to increase their voice in these things without having it become a complete zero sum thing. The winner takes it all.
Okay. And, you know, I would add, I mean, ultimately, you need, in addition to any structural reforms, I mean, structural reforms that increase the kind of buy-in are good. But ultimately, you know, internet law in general relies on the norm of complying with the law, right? I mean, and the U.S., so the U.S. would need to start setting an example of consistent compliance and calling out nations that don't. It had an opportunity to do that big time at the end of the Cold War, failed to, but maybe it's not too late. So why don't we talk about, some of the dynamics. So we talked about, you know, Security Council, which can do a lot of things, although preventing war was what they mainly had in mind when they first created it. But it can levy sanctions and it could authorize an intervention to do almost anything, honestly, in the name of whatever the phrase is, international peace and security. But let's talk about some of the dynamics that are in my mind making it more important that we come up with a structured way of dealing with threats of a transnational nature. So, it seems to me the bioweapons threat is only growing as biotech advances. I'm agnostic on the Wuhan lab leak thing, but it definitely could have happened and it could happen in the future. And what that tells you is the thing is not adequately regulated at the international level. And, you know, AI, as people have pointed out, has some of the properties of biological weapons in the sense of being not as easy to monitor as nuclear weapons, and having the possibility of some kinds of transnational threats. You know, there are health threats. I mean, even pandemics of natural origin. There's a lot of stuff. And so why don't you kind of pick a thing that you want to talk about, or talk about them generically if you want.
That's an awesome question, Bob. It gives me great freedoms. Can I say one thing on Security Council? Because tying it back to our earlier conversation about, well, is this realistic or not? And is this in the interest of the United States? Well, again, put yourself in 2040. The world has, you know, the US's share of power has continued to shrink. It's still most likely the most powerful country in the world, but the unipolar moment is long over. I mean, just take a look at how the world looked like today, and it's quite clear. And then the question then is, well, why would it be in the US's interest to agree to some of these things? Well, the alternative is that if we don't agree to some of these things, then we won't have a Security Council at all, which means that the US actually completely loses its veto and a very crucial avenue to be able to exercise its influence. Moreover, in a world in which you have a larger number of middle powers in addition to great powers, and many of these middle powers start behaving just like we did during the unipolar moment because we set the norms. I mean, when you take a look at what Israel and Turkey is doing in Syria right now, for instance, or what the Iranians have done in Iraq, they are relying on the very same norms that the United States established through the global war on terror, which apparently all norms around the use of force are put aside if you just claim that the one that you're bombing is a terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
So in a world in which more countries start behaving like that, that's actually a very dangerous world for the United States. And in that type of a world, our need and our interest in finding various ways to bind these rising powers, middle powers, and great powers to norms and laws that actually restrain much of their behavior is going to grow dramatically compared to what it is today. And this is the big shift in us understanding of what a multipolar world looks like. It's not just that there's going to be a couple of more other countries. We're going to have an interest in finding new ways of binding these states, and norms, laws, and rules are going to be a crucial element of that. And in that scenario, it is our estimation that the United States actually will have a significant interest in this. And as you saw from the 130 people who are part of this project from 40 countries and a very large number of Americans, of course, how many of them signed on to not only participated deeply in the proposal making, but also signed on to the final package of proposal. So again, if you're judging it from today, yes, I agree 100%. There's no way the United States would agree to that today. 15 years from now, multipolar world, more middle powers that are behaving in a way that is highly problematic to us, I think we will find the U.S. having a very different type of an interest. And that interest, I think, will lead, drive the U.S. towards some of these proposals that we have put forward.
Yeah. Now, I mean, well, let me just quickly say, what's worrisome is that past major revisions of architecture like this have happened only in the wake of utter catastrophes, namely World War One, League of Nations, World War II, the UN, which was an improvement on the League of Nations after they saw the League's failures. But I just hope, you know, we don't need a disaster of that magnitude or even greater, let alone a disaster that you can't even recover from to the extent of building a new architecture. But anyway, go ahead.
And you know, one of the differences this time around is that we're actually facing existential threats. So the idea that we actually have to have a crisis before we change it, we may not have that luxury any longer because the existential threat of whether it's nuclear war, or whether it is pandemics, or whether it is climate are of such nature that after those, we may not have the opportunity whatsoever to go forward with any type of architectural reforms. That's why this time around, we simply have to do better.
Yeah.
Now, as to your question of, you know, what we, you know, some of these other proposals, perhaps one that I think is of interest is on AI. A lot of the work on AI right now is different layers of dealing with what AI may or may not do, whether it's in weapons, it's about getting some degree of norms and regulations around its use, as well as mechanisms for prevention. And all of those things, you know, are things that we find to be very constructive, useful. They should be more inclusive than what they are right now, particularly when it comes to regulations. Because if it's not inclusive, eventually the whole thing will likely fall apart. Mm-hmm. What we focused here is essentially on a fail-safe because of a calculation that as useful and as important as preventive measures and regulations are, we have to be realistic about whether they have a likelihood of succeeding. Mm-hmm. And one of our AI experts in this group used this metaphor that I thought was quite powerful in order to understand why the idea of prevention is not something that we can simply solely rely on. We need to have additional measures as well. And that is the fact that if you were to put a cell phone in front of a cave person, that cave person simply does not have the imaginary capacity to be able to imagine what this cell phone can do. It's outside of the realm of its intellectual capacity mm-hmm. or experience to be able to imagine what it can do. And our AI experts' view is that that's what we are vis-a-vis AI. We cannot imagine what AI can do. That's how powerful AI is. As a result, we cannot anticipate what AI will do, and which means that preventive measures, which by nature are based on what we anticipate AI may do, are most likely insufficient. And we need to, the proposal essentially is to put together somewhat of an equivalent of an AI interpool that tries to use AI to check on AI. Because it's the capacity of AI to anticipate what AI will do that will be important for us in order to make sure that we don't end up with a rogue AI, that actually acts outside of human control. And that risk, again, preventive measures, regulations are important, but we had perhaps a bit of a darker view and thought that as much as that those things should be continued, we also need to have a third layer of protection to make sure that we don't end up with rogue AI.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing that I think is important as we head into the AI revolution is that we stand reasonably good terms with China. I mean, these are the two AI superpowers, the U.S. and China. You would like to have some degree of cooperation between them, a certain amount of transparency and so on. And of course, U.S.-Chinese relations have been heading in an unfortunate direction, if that's your goal. Do you have a kind of a theory of why that's happened so fast? I mean, in a way, it's overdetermined, I guess. There's plenty of factors that went into this. But, have you been surprised at all by how rapidly relations kind of deteriorated and how rapidly you started seeing pretty brutal kind of economic and technological warfare. I mean, the chip restrictions on China, I'm sure, are viewed by China as like a major assault. I don't know. What's your take on U.S.-China relations?
So not my area of expertise. So let me first start off by saying that. But I agree with you by and large. And clearly, we're seeing now that the Chinese are retaliating against that. And a lot of what we are doing in this project explicitly or implicitly presumes that we have not ended up in a full confrontation with the Chinese. If we do, then I think, you know, it's game over and we may have to look at these proposals after the apocalypse, essentially. It is absolutely essential. But at the same time, just going at this from a U.S.-China angle also kind of misses a significant dynamic in the world, which is, yes, we may end up in some form of a bipolar, multipolar world in which there will be two major powers at the top, but it will still have a multipolar characteristics in some aspects because we're going to have a much larger number of very powerful middle powers. And that is one of the critical things that has happened here. It's not just the rise of China that's important. It's the rise of the global South. If we then move to just some sort of a U.S.-China concert, in fact, this is what Trump may have hinted at. I mean, I think it was positive that he has pointed out that U.S. and China can work together in Syria, for instance, et cetera. It's very different from what the Biden administration has said. But a lot of other countries are also very suspicious of this because they're fearful that it's just going to lead to a U.S.-China concert shutting out everyone else. And I'm very skeptical about that approach as well, because again, the rise of the Global South is a major, major development in all of this. And something that is just solely based on the U.S. and China working things out is going to have some deep, deep flaws, perhaps as deep as those of just thinking that we can go forward with a 1945 architecture. So that's my way of pointing out to you that, yes, U.S.-China, very important, particularly on AI. It's crucial. But if we think that just resolving it with them is sufficient, I think we're going to have to think again.
Yeah, I mean, I think it seems to me a little unlikely that the U.S. and China would be so much on the same page that they weren't doing any kind of competition on the geopolitical stage that involved cultivating good economic relations with various countries and so on, you know, including, you know, equivalents of Belt and Road initiatives and so on. But so I'm a little less worried about that than you are. And I'm quite worried about an ongoing deterioration of relations. So I was kind of relieved to hear Trump in somewhat oversimplified form saying that the U.S. and China together could solve, as he put it, all the world's problems. I wouldn't go quite that far.
I wouldn't go as far as that, but I think it actually, again, of course, if he means it, if he implements it, it is a very crucial development in a positive way. I can tell you conversations I had with Chinese diplomats right after October 7th, and they wanted to assess whether there was an opportunity for them to step in diplomatically. As you know, they had just done the Iran-Saudi agreement that till this day is still in place and actually has been very positive for stabilizing matters in the Persian Gulf. It was very clear to me from their conversation, they were not looking to use Gaza and the U.S.'s increasingly isolated role there to further isolate the U.S. or embarrass the U.S., even though, to be frank, that could have been quite easy for them to do. That was a low-hanging fruit. They were looking for ways to see how can they actually partner with the United States and use resolution of the crisis in the Middle East to showcase the U.S. the benefits of collaborating with the United States. The Biden administration had no interest in this because from their standpoint, collaborating with China on these issues would be essentially accepting that China has become a peer and that the U.S. and China are more or less equal and as a result, they should team up. That was like completely opposite to anything the Biden administration believed, in which it was essential for the United States to remain the unipolar power, whether it is through brute force or by creating these coalitions through the rules-based order, et cetera. If Trump is open to actually collaborating with the Chinese on areas in which that collaboration can be fruitful, that I think is much more pragmatic. And ultimately, despite the fact that he doesn't seem to have any warm place in his heart for rules, laws, or international governance structure, nevertheless, that pragmatism can lead us in a better direction.
So, Trita, as you know, the final part of our podcast is called Overtime, and it is accessible to Non-Zero members, you know, as paid subscribers to Non-Zero newsletter, and we are about to head into overtime. And once we do, we're going to talk about not only this, but maybe get into some one regional issue, the Middle East. I mean, you're an expert on Iran. You've written, I think, three books related to it. And so I want to talk a little about the new Middle East, including Iran's place in it. And that will draw on some themes from this conversation. I mean, obviously the nuclear issue is a big one, and the relationship of Iran and for that matter Israel to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. But before we go into overtime, is there anything else you want to say about the project? I mean, there's a ton there. We could have a 5-hour conversation about it. I encourage everyone to take a look.
I think perhaps in the second part, we can talk a little bit about the Middle East proposals that the project put forward. Mm-hmm. But before we go there, could I say a couple of things about economic sanction?
Sure.
Because I think that's going to be a big issue. I mean, obviously, when it comes to the international infrastructure of the world, there's a tremendous amount of reforms. The IMF needs reforming. The World Bank needs reforming. And we recognized that we didn't have necessarily the right expertise to put forward proposals on those issues that really moved the ball and had a significant value add. Our focus was very much on security. But there's an element of the security order that really does feed into the on the economic order that does feed into the security order, which is that this dramatic increase of economic sanctions, particularly extraterritorial financial sanctions, risks really creating separate economic orders, I mean, the decoupling, et cetera, which then can also help fuel the creation of separate security orders. Mm-hmm. So that was something that we wanted to address. And as I'm sure you know, the U.S.'s use of economic sanctions have been quite dramatic, increased exponentially. But other countries are not doing it as well. Australians told us that their increase, their use of economic sanctions has increased 500% in just the last 2 years. So we're going to move towards a world in which not only there's going to be more unilateral sanctions, we're also likely going to see the Chinese and others with relatively strong currencies start using financial sanctions in the manner that the United States has. I mean, we saw the United States, because of its power and its control, because of the dollar, of course, could shut out Russia from the international financial system in 5 days. They've been using those sanctions against Iran for some time. There are no rules, laws, or norms around the use of these types of sanctions. We have a whole body of law when it comes to war, making sure that the conduct of war follows certain principles, that there's professionality, that there's some protection for civilians. Nothing when it comes to economic warfare through sanctions. So we're making proposals on the first hand to just get some clarity. Is the U.S.'s use of financial sanctions, as the U.S. says, domestic application of law, because these transactions do shift through every time the dollar is used, it does go through the Treasury in Washington for at least a split second, or is it extraterritorial? That's a crucial question. If it is extraterritorial, then we need to have some guidance and rules around that. And even though, again, the United States today has no interest in any rules or laws regulating its use of these sanctions, rest assured, the minute the Chinese start using the same instrument, we're going to have plenty of interest of making sure that there's some rules of the road for that. And this is what we're trying to do in the project, you know, developing those rules and laws already now so that we're prepared for that moment, because that moment will come. But also making sure that as these sanctions, the use of these sanctions increase, that we use and we borrow some principles from international law to develop regulations on how do we manage the civilian impact of these sanctions. How do we manage it? Because as you saw in Iraq, for instance, the number of innocents that died as a result of sanctions, which oftentimes people tend to view as, you know, a really neat alternative to war. Whereas in reality, it's just a different way of conducting war that in many ways is even more brutal, more lethal, and completely freed from any regulation and law. And going forward in, you know, 15 years from now, that's going to be a disaster if we haven't fixed this.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, yeah. And also our kind of prolific use of sanctions gives other countries an incentive to displace America's kind of privileged position at the acme of the financial system, including, you know, the use of the dollar as the world's kind of reserve currency. Now we're heading into overtime. Again, you can go to the Non-Zero Newsletter Substack, become a paid subscriber. Then you can set up a special podcast feed that will always give you access to this stuff, as well as a lot of bonus content in the newsletter itself. Thanks, everybody who's stuck around this far, whether or not you're going to follow us, but I encourage you to follow us into overtime. It's a wild time and a wild place, overtime. Thank you so much, Trita, for agreeing to stick around and talk more about this. And again, the name of the report is Toward a Better Security Order, available online. And everybody should check out that and the other various other products of the Quincy Institute.